Yeah, what up? Welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guest is Scott Olson. Scott is an organizer with Iraq Veterans Against the War and really got his start at Occupy Oakland when he was hit with a fucking flashbang grenade in the head, which galvanized a huge outcry that led to the first general strike being called in, I don't even know, 50 years or some shit, maybe 100. But yeah, we talk about a lot of shit. We're going to talk about ISIS, war, militarization at home. We're going to talk a little bit about Occupy Oakland and what that was like and some of the lesser known things about that movement. Scott recently relocated to Wisconsin, where he's building an intentional community based around a culture of resistance and permaculture and shit. It's actually crazy the way we met. I was at Home Depot one day, and I got a PayPal notification on my phone that Scott Olson had bought my album, and I was like, what the fuck? So I emailed him, I was like, this isn't the same motherfucker, is it? He's like, yep, just saw your shit. Political fail blog, don't riot. Next thing you know, we're in Denver on 420. Let's do this. Scott Olson, what's up, man?
Hey, Soul. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to have you here, man. It's a nice day here in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
It's cold.
A little bit.
What are you doing out here?
Well, I came out here for an Iraq Veterans Against the War board meeting. I serve on the board of directors for them. And we had a meeting this weekend with members from around the country to discuss, you know, high-level strategy and organizational priorities for IVAW.
So, like, what are those priorities for the IVAW? What are y'all working on?
Well, like, we basically have, like, four areas that we focus on. One is U.S. militarism abroad. One is veterans' rights, access to care and therapy for veterans. We focus on basically reparations and the U.S. taking account for how it has affected people who are affected by U.S. militarism, and also militarism in our schools and streets, recruiters in schools, police militarization, and what refugees go through when they're living here, and what veterans go through when they come back.
That's cool, man. I think it's interesting that y'all are including, like, militarization at home as part of the struggle.
Yeah, it's just an extension that has grown out of it being so prevalent worldwide. You know, it really comes into, like, a lot of veterans join the police, and a lot of veterans are victims of the police, so it's very intertwined.
Do you think, like, veterans with PTSD joining the police is a big problem in?
Yeah, that's a big problem. You know, when you have PTSD, especially from war, it's almost like you're stuck in that frame of mind that you're still at war, and I mean, police get that message already through their training, that the civilians are an other, essentially the enemy, and, you know, when you have a mental illness that reinforces that, it's very dangerous.
Yeah, that's, we had one of the cops that's, like, shot, he shot Ryan Ronquillo, he shot Sherrod Kendall, he shot a couple other people, allegedly, and he was one of the students at Columbine. And when the shooting happened, and his dad led the SWAT attack into Columbine and, you know, basically saved his son.
Right.
And so it's like, here you have this act of, like, this dude is, like, doing what anyone should have done. He's gone in and, like,
right,
stopped these killers from killing their kids. And so, like, but then the son probably has some sort of PTSD from that incident. Jeff Damana is his name. And then he grows up, and he's just, like, ruthlessly killing brown people in Denver, and it's insane.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like he's, you know, playing out this, like, hero story that he inherited from his dad, and, you know, he's just got it all wrong.
I mean, it's fucked up. like 420 weekend is this weekend, and we walked by, and I noticed all the cops were wearing Kevlar helmets. I think they were Kevlar helmets, and it looked like, you know, they were like little occupation forces, you know, at strategic points all over. And it really, even my friends who were with me from out of town, this looks like an occupying army.
You know? Yeah, I mean, and that's something that I've been, you know, that's been clear to me for couple years now, and I've been sort of saying it, like, we ought to be treating the police and talking about the police as if they are an occupying force, similar to what my role was in Iraq. I see essentially zero difference.
Yeah, they're dehumanizing people. It's fucking... well, I came into contact with you through watching Occupy Oakland stuff. I was watching on live stream when you were standing between the cops and the protests and you got injured. Yeah. What do you have to say about that whole experience for you? I mean, what was that like?
I mean, it was, you know, at the time I was only like, I was pretty new to activism, and I felt like a need to be involved, a need to speak out, a need to, especially with my role as a veteran. I thought I had a special role that I could, you know, for like basically a symbolic barrier between the police and the protesters, and you know, that could mean something, and I still think that's important. And but you know, when I got shot by the police with, it was a beanbag round that hit me in the head, and you know, that just it sort of just set me for like life on that path. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just no way I could step down from that anymore.
You know, but then right after that happened, you know, there was a huge outcry. General strike was called. What was it like participating in all that, or seeing all that stuff happening in Oakland? I mean, Oakland was incredible at that time.
Yeah, and like, yeah, the general strike, I was still in the hospital when Oakland shut down the port, and it was just surreal to know that, like, what happened to me was very much like an impetus that was like kind of one of the major causes for why they chose to like have that strike right then. And I mean, I was proud to watch them, you know, doing that. I wish I could have been a part of it. But it was very like, I guess like the opposite of demoralizing. It was very moralizing to like be watching that from the hospital as I'm like recovering from this, and to know that, you know, people weren't going to forget about it. And, you know, if you attack one of ours, we're going to attack back.
Yeah, that's powerful, man. Oakland had a powerful culture of that. I've read, like, you know, everyone, I'll, like, read stuff where, like, you'll go to city council and, like, rail against surveillance shit or whatever they're mm-hmm. trying to do. So that's the thing where Gene Kwan, the mayor of Oakland, was calling you an egomaniac and shit.
Yeah, I spoke at a city council meeting, and it was you know, I was speaking about, like, the topic was basically community trust of the police, and what I was saying to the city council was like, you can't expect the community to trust the police if they aren't even held accountable for what they've done. That's like number one building block. We have to start from there. And afterwards, Gene Kwan pulled me aside, and it's like the side hall of City Hall, and I was asking her, I'm like, well, can you at least tell me who it was that shot me? And she's like, oh, you know, I can't tell you that. There's all these laws, you know, that'd be like a confidentiality thing. And if I told you that, then the city could get sued. Like, well, the city is getting sued by me, so no. And yeah, it was just ridiculous. And she made just like some comment, and you know, it was just disgusting. Like that ought to be the mayor's job, is like to hold her forces to account.
instead, there was like a rift between OPD and Jean Kwan. Like, they felt she went too soft on Oakland. Right?
There kind of was. Like, yeah, the police union was very, yeah, they didn't feel very supported by the city. And, but I mean, they were. Like, the officer who threw the flashbang at me, he ended up getting fired about, like, a year afterwards. He was fired for about 9 months, and his name is Robert Roche, and he was a two-time killer. So they fire him basically for lying to the investigators, not for what he did. Then after my case settled, the union challenged his termination.
Fucking cop.
And the city just put up zero defense against that. And you know, that was a city attorney's job, is to stand behind the city's decision to fire this officer, but they put some new attorney on it. He was on the case for about 2 weeks, and, you know, of course, the cop, he won his case, and he's back in the force with back pay.
Oh my God. It's fucking... You know, it's really funny. I'm taking this critical theory course, and one of the things we're talking about in there is, like, when violent organizations are given power, like the police in our society, they're allowed to use violence to uphold the quote-unquote order, which is right. A violent order. And so when we allow... But when you allow a group like that to commit violence, it then, like, kind of constitutes its own force. It has its own... motives, it has its own, and like you see that with all these police unions all over mm-hmm. the country, like fighting against, you know, like in Denton, is the police union mostly white in Oakland? Is it a mostly white police union? Or
well, the police force is mostly white in Oakland, so, and all the police are members of the union, so yeah, it's mostly white.
Yeah, that's, and so it's like, that's an interesting dynamic, like you have a black police chief in Denver, you have a black mayor in Denver, you have, you know, Jean Kwan in Oakland, and the police unions are like, you're not letting us be violent enough, let us go fucking crack skulls, and if you don't, if you hold us to account, we're gonna fucking...
Yeah, send these letters to City Hall, open letters to City Hall, and say you're not letting us do our job.
Yeah, that must be nationally coordinated, these pigs must all be talking to each other, huh?
I mean, it doesn't really have to be, like, coordinated. It's just, like, they're all, like, on the same shit, on the same program. And, like, they've got the same goals and motives.
When we were getting fucked up the other night, you were talking about, like, white privilege, or maybe not even white privilege, but just, like, how weird it is that all these kids get fucking killed by the cops and see no justice. And, mm-hmm. You know, you just won the settlement with the Oakland Police Department, and, like, how that's, like, kind of a conflict.
It's been a little, like, weird or, like, awkward for me to, like, talk about police violence, especially as it, like, relates to people of color. You know, here I am, this, like, basically middle-class white kid, veteran, who survived a serious police attack, got all this media attention, won millions of dollars in court, and, you know, I'm mostly okay. You know, I, after that, it's like, I really have a hard time, like, even, like, saying anything. It's like Oscar Grant's mom, Alan Bluford's family, you know, people who have, like, lost somebody to police. And here I am, more or less just fine. It's weird, but, I mean, it's still important for me, and, you know, I definitely recognize that, like, I'm the exception to the rule as far as white people being attacked by police. It's an everyday reality, for those communities, and it's so everyday that it, you know, just doesn't warrant any time on the news, right, even though it ought to.
And it seems like when something can take on, like, a viral meme-like quality on the internet, like, those are the deaths that tend to provoke the most outrage, you know? So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, there are other things, like, if something was caught on video, that, like, if it's caught on video, then lately, at least, there's a good chance that it'll, like, be a thing. And, like, but also, like, if there's any, like, doubt as to, like, oh, well, the victim might have had a knife or something,
yeah,
right? Then, you know, there's sort of, like, a, like, apprehension to, like, you know, holding the police to account in that instance. And, but, I mean, like, you know, we just need to come back to, like, okay, like, why were the police even messing with this person?
Right.
You know? And, like, if they weren't, if that person was white, there would have been no encounter. Like, 9 times out of 10, no encounter. So, like, that's something that, like, I think a lot of people forget. And we just need to keep in mind that, like, you know, people are feeling pressured, and even if somebody has a knife, they're no threat to the police. Like, I have a knife and I'm no threat to anybody. Like,
right.
It's just weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've had these conversations. I actually got into it with this cop at the court once, and he was talking about, like, you know, levels of commitment. Like, the cop at that moment can determine if that person could potentially go hurt other people. So that if they can make that rationalization in a split second of whether this person, they can kill you, you know? And,
yeah, it's like they just have to, like, play this possible scenario in their mind. Like,
worst case scenario.
Right, yeah.
And it's like assuming, like, the police assume that everyone in the world is a homicidal maniac.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, that's kind of, like, their training is, like, the only people that can trust are other police. And you know, civilian populations are essentially painted as the enemy, and that's reinforced through, like, trainings like Urban Shield, and when they do these trainings, where, like, every training scenario they go through is, like, a homicidal maniac or, like, a yeah. terrorist, right? And, like, that's all they're trained on. That's all they're exposed to. So that's, like, they're the products of their training, too, right?
Yeah, Urban Shield is that big cop conference that happens in Oakland, right?
Yeah, it's been happening in Oakland, and it's not supposed to happen there this year. That was the last I heard, right? But it's still going to happen in Alameda County, just not the city of Oakland. But, it, you know, it doesn't really matter which city it's in. A couple weeks before I was shot, there was Urban Shield that was in Berkeley, but OPD participated in it, training alongside Israeli forces and you know, other forces from the Middle East. And, yeah, and they say it's to, like, address these emergency scenarios, but, like, half their training scenarios are against crowds. Like, you know, like, no, that's not an emergency.
Oh, my God, it's an emergency for y'all. Yeah, right. And that's the shit that fucks me up. It's just that people are giving no means to fucking redress their grievances. Like, people protest, people do things, and, like, as soon as a protest becomes effective or any kind of movement becomes effective, they just throw the book at them, lock everybody up, get everybody hemmed up in the court, beat their asses, slander them in the media. I mean, they're fucking, I fucking hate them, man.
But, I mean, like, you know, I think we also need to remember that it's not an all-powerful enemy, you know? And I think that there is, like, this complex on the left that, like, the government's just, like, essentially God, right? Like, they know everything, they can do anything, unlimited resources, but none of that's true. Like, their resources are limited, you know? They can't fuck with everybody.
Right.
They only have so many people, so much money. So, you know, just because you're looking, like, at pictures of weed on your computer doesn't mean they're gonna come bust your door in, right?
Right, totally. So, yeah, I feel like they rely less and less on brute force and more on, like, propaganda and pacification. And to me, that's, like, what really brings it home, that they're actually an occupying army, because they're, like, trying to win hearts and minds.
Right, and it's just, like, it's the counterinsurgency doctrine, you know? Like, counterinsurgency does not rely on, like, you know, killing everybody. It relies on hearts and minds and delegitimizing the insurgents, your opponents, right? So, you know, they're very effective in that, at that, and they've, and there's been this, like, back and forth between the military and the police, basically since the 70s, like, each are learning from each other these coin tactics, counterinsurgency tactics, and there's this very good book called Life During Wartime, published by AK Press, and, you know, it really breaks that down, like, things like gang injunctions, you know, they're a tool of, out of the counterinsurgency toolbox. Or just like, you know, just breaking up the ability of each of us to organize ourselves. And that goes into propaganda in the mass media and what most people eat for their brains, right?
All right. What are your thoughts on Bergdahl, man, on Bo Bergdahl, the veteran who was leaving to report war crimes from one base in Afghanistan and then was picked up by the Taliban. And he's charged with, like, embarrassing himself in front of the enemy, I think.
Yeah, or yeah, it's like... something like that. Yeah, like, poor conduct in front of the enemy, or, like... That's the way we treat whistleblowers, is to, like, assign different motives, you know? We say the motive was, like, oh, he wanted to join the Taliban, really. But, you know, this is, you know, a young man who, like, joined the U.S. military, probably with, like, good intentions. And, you know, he wanted to, like, protect America and like, fight, like, an oppressive force. The Taliban is an oppressive force, right? And, I mean, I don't know what to think about him. He, where is he now? Do you know where he is?
I think he's in Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah.
In prison, or
no? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he's in Quantico or some shit. Yeah, I have no idea. I was just, I guess to me, it's like one of those things where you just see right wingers just going crazy about this guy. You know, calling him a traitor, and you know they're not the ones who go fight wars.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and it's like, you know, when you're in that position, like especially the military, and you know you've got like some beans to spill, like a whistle to blow. There isn't like a way to do that, like through the official channels.
Right.
And like, I think like going off base and like trying to go to a different base, that's kind of crazy. Like I would never do that. Like that's nuts. But I mean, you know, more power to him if that's what it was and, not very well thought out, but, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do sometimes.
Well, I don't know, man. So what do you think about, like the PKK and the Kurdish resistance to ISIS in Kobani and Rojava and like all that stuff that's happening right now?
I think that's, they're like the lead force fighting against ISIS. And they haven't really asked for like outside support. They don't need it. They're well organized, and you know it's they have a long tradition. You know, Kurdistan has been like fighting state forces for years now, especially since our invasion of Iraq. They've essentially carved out like their own autonomous region in northern Iraq, and I've had a couple of friends like seriously consider going over to fight with the Kurds against ISIS. Friends from the military. I don't think any of them did. And you know they don't need our help really. They're especially like, you know, these battalions of women. Like that's super cool to see. Like that's. I don't know.
That you know, I mean, like, you know, it's so funny. It's like ISIS is such a terrifying They do so much fucked up, right. crazy, insane shit. But, like, you know, it must be equally as terrifying to them to have women firing at them.
Yeah.
You know, you were in Iraq, right? You were. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think about, you know, what do you think about ISIS and the rise of ISIS? And
sure. Yeah. I'll talk about that a bit. So, like, I guess starting, like, when I was in Iraq, I was over there twice. My first time was in Al-Qaim, which is on the Euphrates River and the Syrian border. So way out west. And the second time I was at Haditha Dam, which is closer to Baghdad on the Euphrates River, though. And Al-Qaim was one of the first cities that ISIS had influence in. And since I left Iraq, I've had a specific, like, interest in, like, Western Iraq. The areas where I was, like, I've cared about, like, how it's developing, how the people there are doing. And, you know, I've been hoping the best for the Sunni population there. So I was hearing about ISIS, about, like, 6 months to a year before they were, like, a thing in the media, before, like, most Americans knew what they were. You know, it's not surprising that they've been able to gain so much support, you know, because the Sunni population, who has been essentially disenfranchised since we've installed Nouri al-Maliki as PM, who is Shiite, so they've been disenfranchised since then, basically. So they were having these popular protests in Iraq, these popular nonviolent protests in Iraq, and they were getting continually put down by the government. And so I was like, all of a sudden, here comes this group, like, out of Syria, basically, with arms and with a new strategy to, like, fight the government with arms. And I was basically happy to see this. Happy to see that somebody was fighting against this illegitimate government. So, like, it's no surprise that they were able to gain that rank and file support. And this is before they were doing, like, all this horrific shit, before they were doing beheadings, smashing antiquities, right? So then they got all crazy. And now we're seeing those same villages of Sunnis in Western Iraq, they're resisting ISIS now. They're not all that they were cracked up to be, right? So, I mean, like, the U.S. should not be surprised at all of the outcome. You know, we've been saying for years that just because the American military left Iraq doesn't mean war is over. Like, it's not that, like, count, like, it doesn't matter if we're there or not. Like, we started it. We started the ball rolling. I certainly didn't expect ISIS to come out of that. I knew stuff was going to get worse, but I didn't expect something like ISIS. And you gotta, like, sow what you reap, basically.
Yeah, it's been insane, insane to watch. I mean, what else is insane is you have the Iranian-backed Shias in the south, and then you have, like, it's almost like the Spanish Civil War. A lot of people compare it because, but one of the things that it also fucks me up, you know, when you think about, to me, the invasion of Iraq set off this, you know, unpredictable chain of events, you know, like, I feel like that destabilization of Saddam, I feel like with the Arab Spring, a lot of motherfuckers mm-hmm. were like, you know what, like, we could be next, like, fuck our dictator, or for what, however right. it was going down, and then, like, you know, and then you have, like, ISIS come up out of Syria, and then you have, like, autonomous regions that have mm-hmm. propped up and are, like, living basically under, like, these anarchist autonomous societies. Like, I don't know. Like,
yeah, and it also, like, you know, it sort of goes back to, like, the fall of the Ottoman Empire when Britain and Western forces, like, drew these borders. And these borders were, like, drawn to, like, split populations. Like, Iraq has, like, you know, like, 30% Sunni, like, 30% Shiite, and, like, Kurds and other ethnic groups as well. And they're not, like, natural borders. They're, like, it seems as though they were designed
Like, they've always been there.
Right. Yeah, it seems as though they were designed to, like, cause instability, but because we had, like, for example, in Iraq, we supported Saddam Hussein, and, like, he was, like, secular Sunni, basically, and he was able to maintain stability through violence, right? But, like, in amounts of stability with our support. But it's, like, all we need to do to get rid of that, to cause this instability, was, like, get rid of him, right? And it's almost, like, by design that region, through its borders and through its history of colonialism.
It's so fucked. It's so sad. I mean, when you think about, you know, a couple of years ago, it was, like, debatable whether or not a million people or a couple hundred thousand have died. Now it's, like, how many million have died in these wars? You know, why do you think people aren't going crazy? Like, people certainly, you know, shut shit down during Vietnam. Like, why aren't people shutting shit down against these endless wars?
Well, I think a couple of reasons, and you just said one of the reasons. It's endless, right? And, you know, this is a war that's been going on for 10 years, and there was, like, mass opposition at the beginning, and the war still happened. It's still happening, right? And there, I mean, obviously not enough resistance, but there's been a lot of resistance. And it's almost been, like, a new norm, like, a war in the Middle East, of course, right? It's taken for granted. And it is just like, what more do we do? Right. You know? This, like, military apparatus seems so big and monolithic and you can't move it.
Yeah, I mean, we're being crushed under the weight of our military. You know, the Pentagon, you know, just these massive, useless military expenditures. It is such a fucking waste.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, you know, we've, since the start of our invasion of Iraq, like, we've also faced mass austerity around the world, even in the U.S., and, like, we've had an increase in issues like gentrification. You know, we have stuff to take care of here, like, just getting worse here. Right. You know, and militarism is invading here as well. You know, it's hard to focus on, like, a war on the other side of the world when, you know, there's war here as well.
Totally. Totally. I mean, that's why I think, also, we were talking last night about how, like, you know, it seems like people who are typically older are anti-war, like, at mm-hmm. their core, or, like, against the war. Like, that's their thing.
Right.
Whereas it seems like a lot of young activist people, like, post-Occupy, are against the police, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I think that has to do with the fact that, like, you recognize the police because you've been beaten by them, you've watched people get, like, you've seen them terrorizing mostly nonviolent protests,
right.
And that shit has a fucking effect, man. People are pissed off. From the perspective of, you know, like, military thinking and stuff, looking at, like, the current wave of anti-police stuff that's happening around the country, like the Black Lives Matter and various things in different cities, what kind of, you know, what kind of, I don't want to say advice, but, like, when you look at how these things are playing out, like, what would you like to see, or what kind of stuff are you kind of, you know, how are you thinking about those struggles?
Yeah, I mean, and there's, it's been strong, for one. Like, it's been really strong, and it's been uplifting to see, that amount of activity. You know, people who weren't brought out for Occupy because their communities were being killed by the police.
Right.
You know? They're like, well, shit, we don't care about, you know, this economic crisis or, you know, whatever Occupy is about. Like, we're under attack, you know, and now we've got that movement, and those people are activated, and there's, you know, a lot of talk about where to go. Like, there's been a huge increase in, like, cop watching in black communities. Especially like in Ferguson, like there's hundreds of cameras, like, and we've done like cop watching training there, and you know, that's part of it. And there's also been talk about basically like going back to like self-defense, armed self-defense. And I almost hate to say it, but I think that might be the only thing that can really like stop these police killings. If the police are already acting like we're like shooting at them and, right, and but they're shooting at us. And you know, what more they can, what more are they going to do? Like, they're already killing us, right? So if they're already like treating it like the worst case scenario,
right?
I mean, I suppose the police could get a whole lot worse.
Yeah, and actually start killing more white people too, you know. But the fucking, yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, I've definitely been watching like the Huey P. Newton Gun Club out of Texas, you know, and that shit's fucking inspiring. I mean, it's right, like there's hundreds of people, you yeah, know, doing open carry protests, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That must scare the shit. Did he just, I just heard about some black guy was elected mayor in Missouri, and five out of six of the cops in his city just resigned.
Five of six.
Oh my god, man. Yeah, and you know, then it gets back to all this other shit, like, you know, the Klan's influence on like the Denver Police Department's has a long history of being like in bed with the Ku Klux Klan, and like that's
right. People act like the Klan is dead, like it's no more. Maybe it's like mostly dead, like in name or as an organization, but like that mindset isn't dead, you know, and it's still alive as and well. And especially like I know in Oakland, like throughout like the 1960s and 1970s, Oakland specifically imported police from the South.
Really?
Right. They specifically imported racist police. And, you know, that's been like just something that's permeated throughout the culture, and maybe they don't do that anymore, but like that mindset is still like in the culture of OPD.
That's fucking crazy. I mean, it's no surprise. Oh, you know what we were talking about last night, just that I thought was interesting? I was asking you about Occupy the Farm,
mm-hmm,
and like some of like the more artistic projects that came out of Occupy Oakland, like the Aquapie,
right,
the Floating House.
Yeah.
You were talking about this lot, the Biblioteca Popular. That was your favorite project. That came out of,
sure.
I didn't hear very much about that at all. So what was it about that project? What was that project about?
So basically, like in Oakland, it was in a mostly Latino neighborhood. There was this abandoned building that, like, for many years was a library, but like since the 90s it's been abandoned because the city can't fund it, right? So like since the 90s this abandoned building that's been used as a shooting gallery, as you know, places for underage hookers and like a dump basically. So this abandoned blighted building that's been attracting crime to this neighborhood. Basically, like, a few, like, anarchists broke into it, and turned it back into the library. They were, like, doing it up, you know, cleaning up the interior, and putting the bookshelves back in, putting books back in, and, got a lot of, like, huge neighborhood support. And, you know, like, it was mostly neighborhood support, like, it was a project that wasn't, like, very well known even, like, throughout the activist community in Oakland. Like, it was more of a neighborhood project. Now, like, one mistake that these organizers made is they put out a press release, like, the day after they opened it up and turned it back into the library. You know, it wasn't really on its feet. So, like, the night, it got media attention. That very night, OPD raided it, kicked them out. And we were able to get access to the backyard of this library and to still have this community support. We still had, you know, neighborhood barbecues and had, you know, tons of neighborhood kids and parents thanking us, you know, and being glad that, like, this problem building is now, like, something that's, like, a solution building, right? And,
nice.
So, yeah. So
that's a nice catchphrase.
Yeah, I just thought of that.
Problem building is now a solution building.
I should go into marketing. But no, you know, they, and as far as I know, like, they still don't have access to the building, but they're still using the backyard as, like, a community center, planting, you know, gardens and stuff. And, like, it, from what I could tell, like, it really changed the dynamic in, like, that couple block area. You know, like, it seemed like a kind of like a dirty place where you didn't really want to walk by. But, you know, it became, like, a lot safer in that neighborhood. And it was, like, it was a big win, but we almost got, like, we almost jumped the gun on declaring a win. And, you know, if we had, like, waited a good, like, week or so before we alerted the media, then we could still have access to that building. Maybe police wouldn't have been able to raid it if there was that built-in community support.
There's no exact science to win, you know, winning those things.
Right.
That's so easy to go back.
Like, we're all learning, like, and, that, you know.
But, it's, you know, I think it's also important to admit, like, hey, we should have done this. I mean, I'm always doing that in my head. I'm always like, we could have done this, we could have done that. I should have done this, I should have done that. And it's always so much easier to tell other people, to give other people advice. Like, oh, yeah.
Have some hindsight.
Yeah, what you need to do is you need to go do this. Like, oh, sure. Like, do you want to give us, like, 20 more people to do that with? Like,
yeah.
Do you want to make Earth's days longer? Like, you want to have a 36-hour Earth day? You know? I don't know. Well, shit, man. All this, you know, you don't live in Oakland anymore. You just moved to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing? What's, like, your main thing you're working on right now?
Well, I just bought some property and, you know, like, both for, like, some of it's just for personal reasons. Like, I kind of need a break from the activist scene for a bit and to, like, be close to my family. But also, you know, I'm on this train for the rest of my life. You know, I'm not gonna stop being an activist. I'm not gonna stop being an organizer. So, you know, I'm basically trying to create, like, a self-sustainable community, with, like, a culture of resistance and hopefully with, you know, people who have been personally affected by the police, by the system, by, you know, whatever you want to call it. Because, like, once you're in that position, once you've been, like, so personally affected by something, it's like, you're done. It's like, you're on that track. I also think that, like, a lot of veterans have, you know, a lot of skills that we shy away from sharing. But these are skills that we're going to need, you know, just things about, like, how to get around undetected, or how to, like, conduct surveillance on a site and find out what's happening there, or specifics about it. You know, and it doesn't, those veteran skills don't necessarily mean shooting, blowing shit up. There's a lot more to it. A thing like Will Potter's doing with a drone, mm-hmm. filming, like, the farms. You know, you don't really need a drone. It makes it a lot easier, but, you know, you could have, like, a 2-man crew or something camped out of a industrial farm and get a good idea of what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need to, like, think more like an underground resistance movement and less, like, you know, like, popular demonstrations are very important, but it seems like they're not going to be enough, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, we need resistance, you know? People are protesting, and that's great, but, you know. anybody can show up with a sign, and it's really easy. It's really fucking easy to ignore people with signs. And if the most we can do is shut down a business for a day, like, capitalism's a lot more resilient than that. You know, the system's right. a lot more fucking resilient than that.
Yeah, and for to, like, go to, like, a protest or something once a month or even once every weekend, like, and to think that's enough, you're wrong. It's not even close to enough. It's not stopping anything. It's the powers that be, right? They've learned how to deal with that.
Yeah,
you know,
I
that's
incorporate that in. See, we're open society. We're right. free.
See, yeah, you got your
you're
free speech.
Heard.
Yeah.
You're being heard.
We'll think about making a change that you suggest, and we'll work on it. Keep on going, yeah.
You know what I do like, though, as far as protesting tactics go? I do like, you know, sustained efforts that are like, anytime this person is showing up, there's right. a group of people there to confront that person, and so yeah. that it becomes impossible for those people to show up in public. And I think that in itself is, you know, that's not to like, that's not to say all protesting is bad.
No.
But it's true. We're kidding ourselves if we think all we have to do is have like the right message.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You have to be like, you have to be strategic and think about like, okay, so how is this protest or other action going to change anything? What's the purpose of this? Is it just to like raise awareness? Just to like
wake people up.
Wake people up. Get some coverage, right? Or you know, are you actually like having like a sustained like shaming of a person or corporation who's a person, of course, right? Is it sustained? Is it could it be effective? You know, just having like a one-day protest against Starbucks or something, like they can take it.
Yeah, totally. And then everybody would go in and get a coffee afterwards. They still like
right.
If I was at a Starbucks protest halfway through, I'd be like, oh man, I need a fucking coffee. You know, this is too much for me. So one of the things you were talking about with your property, you say you want it to be sustainable. And, you know, you're telling me it has, like, a well there, it's got a river, you know, y'all are going to have, like, a permaculture aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lately, as, like, I've been, like, working on my garden and, like, putting in fruit shit, I keep making jokes about how I'm, like, a doomsday prepper and mm-hmm. shit. But, yeah, I guess so. I guess I'm saying, like, in the light of your, in this place you're building, like, you know, are you thinking, like, are you hedging your bets against collapse in some way? You know, are you like, do you see that as like, I mean, a lot of people feel something is coming, or that mm-hmm. we're already living through the kind of death rattles of capitalism.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like I am like hedging my bets against collapse. That's certainly not the only reason. I think it's very like empowering to like have that effect, to be able to like be able to provide most of your food
right.
for yourself or for your community. That alone is empowering. And it builds like a culture that we're going to need post collapse. And
like,
I mean
the collapse that is now, you know,
right.
You know, however you want to look at it.
Yeah. I mean, and we're definitely probably like at the beginning of every collapse, and yeah, but like it's important to also think about like how are we going to like survive once resources are further restricted, and we need to have the place for that. And I mean, it's almost like a responsibility. Like if I had the ability to do that, so I felt like a responsibility to provide that for, you know, my friends and comrades, who I trust.
Yeah, that's good. I was just thinking, I'm like, what will we wipe our asses with at the end of the world? You know, we'll be like, newspapers, dollars, you know.
Dollars.
Like, I always wonder, like, A, when I meet a lot of vets, like mm-hmm. you or Graham or people I've met through the IBAW, yeah. everyone's like, these are intelligent people. Like, how did they sign up for the fucking army? You know, like what?
Yeah.
Like, how did you end up in the army?
I enlisted in the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old, before I started my senior year of high school. I didn't go to boot camp until after I graduated. And basically, I guess my mindset was I wanted to be like a part of something bigger. I wanted to have like a larger impact, fight against terrorism, defend our freedom. You know, I bought that line, essentially.
You're 17.
Yeah, I was 17 years old. And that's like a big reason. Like even like, it's probably bigger than like the economic draft.
By the economic draft, you mean poor people join the army because there's nothing else, right?
Right, yeah. And like, I guess like if you're not poor and you join the military, like that's probably your biggest reason is it's like a noble, honorable thing to do. I mean, it wasn't like, for me, it wasn't anything specific like America, fuck yeah. But it was like more of like, I knew that I was a mostly like moral person. Like I thought I could have like sort of like an effect, like a positive effect on the outcome of the Iraq war, because we were in Iraq at the time that I joined. I pretty much knew that I was going to war, and I just sort of wanted to have like a positive effect. And I kind of learned throughout my time in the military that that was pretty much impossible through that institution. And I was just like complicit in all this shit. But I still very much have and am guided by the same principles that caused me to join the military. You know, it's kind of why I became an activist afterwards. I wanted to become part of something bigger, have a positive effect. It's very much the same. And the military didn't like change those like base like instincts, I guess. And I think that's like why like very common in like veterans turn activists. Mm-hmm. It's like guided by the same principles.
That's interesting.
But just with a new like analysis, right?
And I guess cops are not guided by the same principles, are they? I mean, are they? It's like how come there aren't more moral cops out there going against their brainwashing as cops? You know, you don't hear a lot of cops that, like, turn over to, that show up and become activists.
Yeah, I think, like, one of the big reasons for that, like, I mean, yeah, like, police and military, like, are very comparable institutions, but...
And I'm not trying to, like, glorify the military either.
Right.
I definitely...
Doesn't need to be glorified any more than it is already.
Yeah, we don't need a military.
So, I think, like, one of the big reasons why there's that disparity is... The military is more of like an acute experience. A police, you can always quit, you know, and it's like generally like something learned over like a longer career. Military, you're in it, you know, for like 4 years minimum, basically, and you have no way out, and like intense training at the beginning, and go to war probably. So it's like a very acute experience. So it causes you to like face that, like, quicker. And like a police, it's, you know, it's more of like a career that, you know, you don't want to like lose your career, you know, you got a family to take care of. And like a lot of people, myself included, like I joined the military with like, I never intended to re-enlist. It was always going to be like just one enlistment and that was it. And I think that's true with
just
a lot of
people.
Just because
you felt it was like your civic duty or something.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So, like, I think that's, like, why we see that change is the police, like, you can always quit. You can always, but you don't badmouth it. There's that same, like, sort of, like, expected code of silence in both the military and the police. But, like, you know, the police, like, if you quit Denver Police Department and you want to, like, you know, talk some shit on it or whatever afterwards, like, if you're still in Denver, you could have some problems.
Right.
Right? But, like, the military, like, once you're out, you know, they're not going to send, like, a squad of Marines after you, right?
Totally. Well, no.
Maybe.
I was just thinking, right, as you're talking about that, I just started thinking about Dorner.
Uh-huh.
And I was just thinking, like, maybe that's, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why his outburst was just so violent, was because, like, there was, you know...
Like, you know. Yeah, like, no other ways to go about it, almost, or, like, seemingly, yeah, at least. Seemingly.
Fucking Dorner. Dorner's... Oh, man. That motherfucker. He went out. He went out with a bang.
Yeah. He went out with a blaze, too.
Oh, shit. All right, well, I don't know. I don't... Is there... you know, we didn't talk about surveillance. Do you have anything to say about the surveillance state?
Well, they're listening. So, I mean, I don't know, like, yeah, they're, it was sort of like what I was talking about earlier with, like, surveillance and, like, just because they're listening to everything doesn't mean they're actually, like, listening to
everything.
They don't
know shit.
Right, yeah, I mean, they've got, like, all this, like, archived, like, recordings of phone calls, you know, this is archived right now, and, but, like, just because they have that recording doesn't mean they know everything, you know? The government is, like, it's got limited resources, you know? They can't do everything. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we're talking about mass surveillance. It's important to be careful, and it's, especially if you're, you know, doing some gangster stuff, you have to really, like, safeguard your communications. And... Or just, at that point, you don't use electronic communications at all, regardless of if you're encrypting or whatever. So, you know, it's just sort of like a trade-off we have to think about. Like, do they really care, you know, if we're talking about this, or, you
yeah,
know...
Yeah, do they really care if we're, like, watching some show on Netflix, you know, like, whatever.
Right, or if we're, like, looking up, like, you know, some weed pics or whatever. I mean, mass surveillance is something that's been going on for, like, long before 9/11, and, it's not something that should be, like, scaring us too much. Something that we have to be aware of and live with. And that's just, like, a reality.
Yep. Fuck 'em. Fuck them. I know everybody. I'm like one of the shittiest people with encryption because so many people are just like, you know, hey, here's my encryption key. I'm like, look, you know, that's just, I just think it's a pain in the ass. Like, you know what? Like, we're just, and they're always like, you know, and
yeah.
I hear the arguments. I'm like, your argument is totally valid. I'm totally being a slacker.
Yeah. And you know, if
Tor is so fucking slow, if I wanted to use a dial-up modem, I'd use a fucking dial-up
yeah,
modem.
Yeah, like, these, like, countermeasures against surveillance, like, it's often, like, it's way more trouble than it's worth, and, like, it cuts a lot of people out. Like, if I insist on only using encrypted communications with people, like, I wouldn't be here talking with you.
Especially when you're doing community organizing, and get off Facebook. It's like, sorry, we don't even use email. We only use Facebook. It's like, fuck, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and, like, are you, like, reaching people you want to reach? And, like...
I think we should... I'm going to up my OPSEC. I just need to, man. I know I'm a fucking slacker. And, like... bragging about, like, not encrypting your emails, like, hey, I really don't give a... It's fucking stupid. Any, like, what is the proper way to hug a cop? Like, from the side, or, like, close from the hip, you know?
From behind. Around the neck.
Nice. Alright, man, so if people want to learn more about you, or what your projects are, what are the best ways for people to, like, stay abreast of your work?
Sure. Well, I guess the easiest way is My Twitter handle is at OlsenVet, OlsenVet. You can keep up with what we're doing at Iraq Veterans Against the War at IVAW.org. And yeah, I guess those are the best ways to keep up with what we're doing.
Scott, thank you for your time, man.
Thank you. It was great.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan. And he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the walls. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon to a war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.